This episode is sponsored in part by the Pastor Theologians Conference. Each October, the Center for Pastor Theologians hosts a one-of-a-kind interdenominational gathering of pastors and ministry leaders from across the U.S., exploring some of the most pressing issues facing the church in today's complex world. This year's conference is called Good Shepherds: Pastoral Identity and the Future of the Church. In our contemporary context, the pastorate can often be shaped by visions of leadership that sometimes overemphasize method and technique. We can find this, of course, in church growth strategies, in business-based leadership models, and in social media influencer culture. It's easy when navigating all the details to lose the plot, but October 20th to 22nd, you're invited to Chicago to renew your vision and commitment to following the way of the Good Shepherd. The Good Shepherds Conference will bring together a diverse group of pastors and ministry leaders to reflect together on how we can model pastoral ministry as under-shepherds of Jesus of Nazareth. Speakers include Kate Sonderegger, Matt O'Reilly, Doug Sweeney, Amy Peeler, and many more. Learn more and register at cptconference.com. That's cptconference.com.
The encounters that are fruitful are ones where we begin not with talking points, but with maybe establishing what we share in common. So maybe establishing that we are siblings in Christ. The most important thing to do before even talking more conceptually about some of this stuff is really just to receive someone's story.
The Living Church, serving the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion since 1878. Welcome to the Living Church Podcast. Welcome back, podcast listeners. Today, we'll be looking into some of the tough questions of transgender anthropology and pastoral care. But instead of debating directly over the questions that many other people are discussing, like, should we use preferred pronouns? What is just legislation? How do we talk to kids to affirm or not to affirm? Instead, we concentrate on how to care. So not so much about the questions, though those are important, but today we're going to talk about people. And Christians on the right and on the left can continue to learn together about the experience and discipleship of trans people and loved ones or parishioners with gender incongruence or differing opinions thereof. This particular conversation is not a communion across difference conversation. That might be for another time. My two guests today aren't in substantial theological disagreement about what we discuss. However, in their different experiences, approaches, and relationships with trans people, they bring tons of much-needed nuance and some timely new questions to a traditionally grounded conversation. Who is this episode for, you ask? Well, it's for you. If you are pastorally interested in this topic, or if you're coming from a more progressive perspective theologically, and you're curious about how you might collaborate or converse with more traditionally minded Christians on these things, or if you're more theologically traditional, but you are disturbed by the ways theology you technically agree with gets caught up in prejudice and injustice. My guests today are Dr. Abigail Favalli and Peter Valk. Abby is a writer and professor in the McGrath Institute for Church Life at the University of Notre Dame. She has an academic background in gender studies and feminist literary criticism, and she now writes and teaches on topics related to women and gender from a Catholic perspective. Her latest book, which I read for this podcast and highly recommend, is The Genesis of Gender, A Christian Theory. Peter is a sought-after author and speaker on discernment, vocational singleness, and LGBT+ topics. He's also written for The Living Church. He is the founder and director of Equip, the leading coaching and training solution for theologically traditional churches aspiring to be places where LGBT+ people thrive according to God's wisdom. He is also a teacher and diaconate explorer in the Anglican Church in North America. We discuss together today the importance of language in communicating ourselves to others. We talk about nurturing relationships and opening doors for trust. Are there ways to disagree while communicating care? How do the right and the left both get caught in unhelpful echo chambers and miss the point? How do we affirm the flawed gifts of the human body while engaging its most painful experiences? I found our conversation today instructive as a theologically traditional person, as a member of a messy family, as a neighbor in a diverse community. As a woman, and actually, there's helpful advice here for almost any relationship that you might be in. So I guess this turned out to be, after all, about communion across difference. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Abby, Peter, it is a pleasure to have you here. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Grateful.
Briefly and personally, how did each of you come to be deeply interested in transgender questions?
I think I came into this topic a little bit sideways, in the sense that a very long-standing personal and intellectual interest of mine is the question of woman and the meaning and dignity of woman. And my academic background is in literary studies, but in kind of this combo with women's studies and gender theory. And so I have a background in thinking about the concept of gender. So that is kind of my entry into this conversation, right? Because transgender questions have very much put the concept of gender into a different light, right? So that was sort of my entry into this particular topic, was through the question of women.
I guess I started walking closely alongside some friends and then also some counseling clients who were navigating questions of gender identity, because as, you know, a professional counselor and then as a person who helps run a nonprofit that does training with churches around LGBT plus topics, I kept hearing about this pain, both from people who experience gender incongruence and particularly from parents. A lot of parents who were saying either, I've got a trans kid, how should I be thinking about this? Or my kid has a peer who's going by different pronouns, different names. We don't know what to do about this. And then, you know, add to that the fact that I myself am a gay celibate Christian committed to a historic sexual ethic, which is not the same as being trans, but there's some similarities. So I definitely was feeling deeply this tension between Christian conviction and like compassionate presence. And then more, I guess more recently, some colleagues and I were noticing the really escalating cultural rhetoric, even before the election, but then particularly after the election. And there's a big opportunity for Christian witness in those conversations to either be a barrier to the gospel or a bridge to the gospel. So that's how I'm coming at these conversations.
Peter, you said the word rhetoric, and you also mentioned pronouns. So why don't we jump into a question about language? Language is such a big part of transgender anthropology and of questions of pastoral care and lawmaking and just being polite, like questions of how to be polite and respectful to people. Do we say trans or do we say, I think the old phrase was gender dysphoria, now it's gender incongruence. Is it sex or is it gender? What do those things mean? And then, of course, the question of pronouns, using someone's preferred name. Where do you see language making a difference in how people are able to be cared for well or not?
I think language is enormously important, but it has different meanings, I guess, or different ways in which it's important. So the words that we use shape how we perceive the world in a very real way. And that's actually something that I share with the postmodern gender theorists in a way, that the language we use profoundly shapes our understanding of reality. And so words really matter. And then in addition, words are so important relationally. Words are how you communicate your selfhood to another person. Words are how you receive the communication of another person and how you kind of build a relational bridge. And so I think in this particular conversation, there's so much focus on language because language is so important, but also because those kind of uses of language in some ways create points of tension around this conversation. And a big focus of my own work has been on the word gender specifically. So what does this word mean? And how has it come to mean the many things that it currently means? One of the tricky things about the word gender is that it becomes almost a barrier to communication sometimes, because people are using the same word but meaning very different things by it, and so talking past each other.
Yeah.
And so in many ways, even to have productive dialogue and conversations about this requires a kind of additional step of, well, what do you mean when you say X, or what do you mean by this? Because very often language is being used to convey an experience, and it's very important to be able to understand and receive that experience. But sometimes the words we use actually get in the way of that kind of communication. So that's kind of a general background. I don't think I actually answered the question that you specifically raised, but I'll kick it over to Peter now and see what he's thinking.
The audiences I most often get to speak to tend to be more culturally or theologically conservative on these topics. And so there's a lot of resistance sometimes to pronoun or name hospitality. And I think some of us have gotten maybe in the habit of labeling something as virtue signaling as a way to dismiss the reality of virtue signaling. Like we all do it, right? We all are sending virtue signals. We're all sending messages to trans people and their loved ones with the words we choose to use or choose not to use. You know, we're telling them whether or not we are safe. We're telling them whether we're willing to make an effort to care or not. And there are ways to disagree while communicating care. You bring up the example of gender and how people use the word gender. And for example, the distinction between biological sex and felt gender. You know, what I want to say to believers who maybe are more culturally, theologically conservative is that, okay, maybe the scriptures don't make a distinction between those two, but in order to participate in cultural conversation precisely, right, for there to be clarity about what we're actually saying to each other, and to be able to evangelize people who don't yet know Jesus, who care about trans topics, I think it's really helpful to use that word sex and that word gender in the specific ways that those people we're engaging in conversation with use them. So yeah, I mean, ultimately, I try to hold language with an open hand and use terms like gender incongruence or transgender or even chosen names and pronouns, not necessarily to like endorse an ideology, but to extend hospitality.
Yeah, I think that I think that's a helpful perspective. But the idea that gender is something that could ever be distinguished from biological sex being a concept that's been fairly recently invented. And I think that's important to point out. So now I'm curious if we have on the one hand, you know, the knowledge and the acknowledgement that gender as we use it now, as Peter was talking about, is used in the wider culture now, and gender as an invented concept, how do we balance this hospitality and as Christians being understood by our neighbors, but also keeping in mind this is something that we invented that's not always helpful and might even do some harm in circumstances where I'm able to think of my reality as something that is conceptual rather than something that's given, embodied, concrete, and that those two are at war with each other. Sort of my body has to live up to a certain concept. So yes. What do we do with that? Because, yeah, I think that foundation is important, but also the hospitality piece. So I'm a little torn here. You guys help me solve this problem, please.
Yeah, this is tricky. I mean, the meaning of gender when it was first popularized in second wave feminism was to name the distinction between something that is strictly biological and then something that's more cultural, right? So that's more culturally constructive. And that's a helpful distinction to make, right? There are aspects of how we live out being a woman and man in the world that are more culturally formed than directly natural, so to speak. And so it's important to be able to distinguish between those things. And I think in our time, gender has taken more of a shift once again, maybe especially in the last 10 years or so, where it's come to have more of a subjective meaning. So gender names the felt sense of being a man or a woman. So it names more an experiential dimension. And that's actually a very different understanding of gender, because felt gender, or what's sometimes called gender identity, is often presented as something that's not culturally constructed, but is actually kind of deeply innate, right? It's really an important part of who a person is. One thing that unites both of these concepts of gender is that in their more extreme forms, they do displace the ground of what it means to be a man or a woman from the body, right? So that's something that is both in common. And that's what puts them, I think, those theories in tension with Christian anthropology, the kind of shifting away from sexual difference as the ground of what it means to be a man or a woman. But one important kind of distinction that I think about sometimes is that when someone's talking about, say, their felt gender, their experience of gender, they're articulating an experience, and that really matters. It's important to listen to that and receive that. And I think some of the frameworks in our culture would say that one's experience is one's essence. Like, one's experience is what determines one's nature. And so that's where I would hold a distinction between essence and experience. If someone identifies as non-binary, like, what I hear in that is that this person is trying to communicate to me a very real and important experience that they have of gender. And I can't accept the additional claim that that then determines whether they're a man or a woman or neither, right? Doesn't change substance, doesn't change one's nature. But at the same time, I think that disarms the pronoun question a little bit in the sense that when I receive someone's kind of account of themselves, I can accept that articulation of an experience without necessarily an endorsing a particular anthropology or an account of human nature that I feel I can't endorse, right? So I think in general on the kind of pronoun question, and I've probably wrestled with this more than is like healthy for a person to wrestle with. Like, I think at some point it becomes like, you know, this like Rubik's Cube you're like trying to solve. You just need to like set it aside. I don't think there are hard and fast rules. I think this is something that needs to be discerned carefully and in a kind of responsiveness to the Holy Spirit in particular circumstances and with an awareness of one's role and relationship to a particular person. It's something that has to be discerned with the kind of two goods of language in mind, both language as articulating reality and shaping our relationship to reality, but also language as a relational bridge.
I was imagining this, like if I was speaking to a eighth grade Sunday school class and wanting to help people who weren't trans in that space engage with the culture while not themselves getting confused about their own theology. How I might approach this is that mind-body dualism, for example, is a heresy. We know that there's no way to really separate the fact that we are mind, body, and spirit from each other. They're all intricately, intimately, like interwoven with each other. But one way to think about the words sex and gender is a way to describe the bodiness of who we are in biological sex and the mind and spiritness of who we are in terms of one's felt gender. And so while we can't actually separate those things, these are the words that people in our culture use to kind of describe these things if they were separable.
So how are the eighth graders responding? Are they like, is this a real scenario, by the way? Have you presented this to
No, not yet.
And you know, you're practicing on us.
Yeah.
So if we go to having conversations with people, there's often a feeling of walking on eggshells with any topic of sexuality or gender. I'm always curious about conversations that take risks, that are forthright, that are honest, that say, tell me about your experience, but that also feel free to say, okay, let me tell you about my experience too. Can you handle it? Can I handle you? Can you handle me? Loving conversations with friends, colleagues, or family members with whom one disagrees on this. Perhaps with a friend, colleague, family member who is trans or who is experiencing deep gender incongruence. Have either of you known a conversation like this to go well and be beautiful? You know, where have you grown in this area, or where have you seen God at work opening up doors for people to communicate better about these things?
Yeah. What I found, particularly if someone is not a believer, that tends to lower the temperature of the conversation is, particularly if we know we disagree, is for me to say kind of from the outset that if I have different beliefs about gender ethics than they do, for example, the weirder difference actually between us is that I believe that this God of the Bible exists and knows what's best for me better than I do and will return to make the world right and make perfect all of creation, and I'll live there for all of eternity. That's the crazy idea.
And that you take that seriously.
Yeah. That's the wild idea. And then if I already believe that, and I believe the scriptures teach me who I am and what will lead to fullness of life for me, The other stuff just kind of flows out from that. And we can still disagree about gender ethics, but just trying to shift like where the ultimate source of the disagreement may be. So that kind of sidestepped the question, but I've also found like in those conversations, even like opening up with a little humility around that tends to change it some.
You could use, I know this sounds crazy, but for so many kinds of conversations, I do think that's remarkably disarming.
I do think it's important to have a kind of good rapport, like to establish a good sense of rapport with someone before you maybe wade into like really tricky topics like this. So, I mean, my situation is a little unusual because almost all of the conversations I've had with people has, more recently, has arisen because they're engaging with my work. So the most kind of conversations I have are with fellow Christians who are either trans or experience gender incongruence. It's mostly kind of Christians who engage with my work, whether that's, you know, through disagreement or agreement or whatever. And I find that the fruitful conversations are the ones that are just more human, where we begin not with talking points, but with maybe establishing what we share in common. So maybe establishing that we are siblings in Christ, maybe establishing points of agreement that we have. But I think the most important thing to do before even talking more conceptually about some of this stuff is really just to receive someone's story. And for the past like year and a half or so, I've been working on a project will be like an audio documentary that features a lot of interviews with adult Christians who experience gender discordance and navigate that in a variety of different ways. And it's just been amazing to be on the receiving end of those stories. And in the interviews, the format would often just be like, tell me about your faith. Like, how has God worked in your life? How did you come to faith? And then asking, like, how did your journey with gender play into that, if at all? And it was only after kind of really hearing those stories that then maybe we would go on and talk about some of the more kind of theological or conceptual questions, or even some of the practical questions like what to do with pronouns or things like that. The strength of the bond, I think, is going to shape how productive you can have conversations amidst disagreement and how well a sense of like love and respect is being communicated. I mean, tone matters so much, you know, in these conversations. Yeah. We can't underestimate or overestimate that, I think, especially in our cultural context. But I do think there are just conditions that have to be in place before it's possible to really have fruitful conversations in the midst of disagreement on topics that are so deeply personal and also so charged in our moment.
Yeah, Abby, as you were sharing, two other ideas came to mind after we actually have relationship enough with someone to have these conversations. Two things that I found that also lower the temperature is to recognize the high suicide rates among trans people. And that has to be reckoned with. We can't just hold a certain ethic and ignore the reality of that suicide. We have to make sense of that and offer care to trans people. Also recognizing that Christians on the whole have cared for trans people poorly and committed or stood by as like hate crimes were committed against trans people. And front loading with that kind of confession and that recognition of the vulnerability of many trans people seems to also, yeah, help the conversation after that go better.
I'm curious how else Christian leaders might compassionately care for trans people, like people who have such unique presences and unique needs, medical needs, oftentimes mental health needs, and maybe even unique discipleship needs. What are like the top two or three things that you might want pastors, leaders, teachers to consider when caring for their communities here?
In my conversations with people who, you know, kind of are under the umbrella of this experience of gender incongruence, whether they identify as trans or not, the thing I find continually surprising or just I keep having to remember is how different every story is. Even if you know someone's label, so to speak, you don't know anything about them really yet. So I guess I would say the first thing is to really get to know the person, like take a personalist approach. And then from there, kind of figuring out how best to walk with them into like deeper relationship with Christ. I also think it can be tempting to forefront the issue of gender, especially when we think about like evangelism and discipleship. like, okay, well, let's get this gender thing sorted out and then we'll talk about Jesus, right? Which I think is the exact opposite approach, right? So the priority should be on the connection with Christ and establishing a connection with Christ and deepening a prayer life, and questions about like our identity and sexuality and gender. Those things are best wrestled with on the way up from a deep spiritual life, right? That's where those struggles, I think, become very fruitful in a way. And I would also say that what's tricky about someone who's in a leadership position in a church is that you do always have to hold on to both what's good for the flock and what's good for the individual sheep. And so you have to kind of pay attention to both of those things, like when you're speaking to the whole flock, you know, and making sure that you are presenting the fullness of a Christian anthropology. But then at the same time, especially when dealing more one-on-one or in a more kind of pastoral one-on-one setting, really taking that personalist approach. And that even when speaking more generally, and especially when preaching on topics like this, to do so in a way that someone who has that experience would feel heard and honored. And, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm not saying this is easy. It's really hard, but it's like, this is what we need to do, because it's just so easy, I think, to slip into clickbait sort of rhetoric that is really alienating. And again, this comes from all sides in the polarized debate. So,
Peter, how would you respond?
Yeah, I'd say particularly if you are pastoring like an adult who has shared that they have experienced gender incongruence since childhood, you can probably depend on that their gender incongruence is real and it's probably not going anywhere. And even if you invite them to eventually kind of endure the brokenness, it's really important to recognize that you are asking them to live daily with a painful incongruence. We're inviting someone who, when they look in the mirror, they feel like they're in the wrong body. And then we're asking them to say to the Lord, you know, come, Lord, quickly. And in the meantime, I will resist temptations to remake my body. And instead, I will lean into loving the body I have. But it's painful. And I yearn for your return when you'll make all things right. That's a big ask. That's a really big ask. So yeah, honor their lack of choice in experiencing gender incongruence. Support them as they come to terms with enduring that brokenness and the kind of the suffering that's involved in that in their future. A theology of suffering is lacking in our churches around lots of stuff. It becomes obvious that our churches lack those tools when we get into these conversations. You know, give them permission, I think, to reject like cultural gender stereotypes that mm-hmm. might be even kind of exacerbating or multiplying their experience of gender incongruence. And then I think it's really important to kind of encourage them with people who are safe to share about their story, you know, with siblings in Christ, and maybe even seek out other Christians who are also faithfully navigating gender incongruence to find kind of really special kind of understanding and support there.
Hey, everybody. I'd love to tell you about our next Living Church conference that you don't want to miss. It's in St. Louis in November, and it's called Awe and Presence, a conference on worship and the arts. What do worship, going to church, or the beauty of the Christian liturgy have to do with real life? You can explore with us through art, literature, music, and history how sacraments and sacred rhythms usher us into the awe and presence of the one who is good, true, and beautiful, and forms our lives to his. Speakers include Malcolm Geit, W. David O. Taylor, Abram Van Engen, Grace Hammond, and Matthew Ulver on poetry, prayer, the body in worship, what it means to worship with the church of the past, and understanding the story we're in. Go to livingchurch.org/events for more info and to register, or click the link in the show notes today. And if you register now, you can get a 15% off early bird special. That's livingchurch.org/events, or click the link in the show notes. You mentioned gender stereotypes, Peter, and Abigail, you write extensively about these in The Genesis of Gender. How are they still alive, well, and thriving in the 21st century in the church? What's still going on that is just still creating irritation for people who, for everyone, by the way, but also for people experiencing gender incongruence who are like, I cannot do this, you know, I cannot live into this kind of picture of what it means to be male or female. How's the church exacerbating that right now?
Well, that's a big question. I guess the first answer I would say is that, I mean, stereotypes are basically, they arise from averages, right? They arrive for what might be generally true about a certain group of people in a general sense on the group level. But the problem arises when we take stereotypes and we make them normative or prescriptive and into ideals. So I think we need to make a lot more room for the many different ways that masculinity and femininity are lived out in the world and how that also is part of God's creative design. I mean, the fact that no two women who've ever existed, like billions of women, are exactly alike. So there's this incredible variety among men and women, and we don't need to pathologize, you know, gender nonconformity or what is might be considered gender atypical behavior.
Yeah.
Because that's part of also the wisdom of how we're made. So yeah, I think there is this kind of ironic and regressive narrowing of what it looks like to be a man or what it looks like to be a woman that I think can play into this dynamic in an unhelpful way. So I think we need our churches to make room for people being a little more eccentric, you know? who dress in ways we don't expect, you know, and to not overly moralize that. I don't feel any compulsion to burden someone's conscience over what they wear, you know, barring some maybe like real extremes or something. Yeah. So I think there's a lot more we could be doing better about embracing the variety within each sex than we currently do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It seems to me that part of the challenge is it's not just Christians who are drawn to the maybe efficiency of gender stereotypes or the ease of kind of an overly rigid gender binary. It's kind of generally in the culture. I mean, there's maybe the stereotypical like queer theory, deconstruct the gender binary, secular approach that suggests that kind of both felt gender and biological sex are kind of on a spectrum or even useless concepts, and we should get rid of those. But there are just as many people who hold a more progressive Christian ethic on these questions or a more secular ethic on these questions that believe that it's really important to preserve the gender binary of like male-bodied men and female-bodied women. And that matters, you know, but it's just that some people's body don't match their sense of gender and they should have the freedom to make that fit. Like people like Caitlyn Jenner maybe represent this view that they seek to change their body to align with their gender identity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even within kind of like the secular maybe or progressive schools of thought on this, there's critique of that approach that it reinforces gender stereotypes and leaves people feeling more distressed, especially if they choose not to medically transition.
Yeah. And I think there's a good intuition there. I think the good intuition that gets distorted is that being a man and being a woman is like a good reality. Like it's a good feature of our world. And there's something mysterious about it that is irreducible. And that's what I think is the impulse we have to resist, is wanting to reduce the kind of mystery within like what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman into almost this like algorithmic kind of like you have these traits and you like these things and you look this way. We like to over define and almost limit, I think, the mystery rather than letting it remain open.
There's something about the theater of being human that seems to me to include the roles that we play, and those can be prescriptive in harmful ways. But I've also seen people live out the theater of their femaleness or maleness with just so much joy or even extravagance or even eccentricity, like you mentioned, Abigail. There's a kind of presentation of self, which I think has a theatrical element. What do you guys think about that? Do you think that could be helpful in dealing with some of these questions, to think about like the theater of the body or the theater of expressing one's sexuality in the world?
I think in our time, we're very much concerned about the theater of the body, so that it really kind of transmits the authenticity of who I really am. Mm-hmm. And again, there's like a good intuition to that in the sense that that is the primary function of our bodies, is to reveal our personhood to the world. Our material bodies make what is invisible about us, our spiritual, like what you were saying earlier, our kind of spiritual component. That's what the body does, is transmits that into the world. But I think sometimes we transfer the kind of work we maybe need to do on our interior life onto our external appearances, right? Like if we can kind of make the body into a project, then that maybe is a way of dealing with not dealing with some of the work we should actually do that's more on kind of an building an interior life and cultivating virtue and cultivating a rich connection with God. You think about someone like Mother Teresa, right? Who by conventional beauty standards was very homely in so many ways, but if you hear descriptions of people who meet her, she has this kind of like spiritual gravitas to her that just shines through her body. It's important to remember that our bodies matter. That our bodies do show the world who we are in a certain way. But that purpose of the body is doing its best work when our interior lives are grounded in holiness.
Is there something that as you listen to folks on the right and folks on the left discuss and debate, is there anything that you're just really not hearing them say that you would love for people to pay more attention to here? What would you say to folks on the right and on the left to say, hey, let's pay more attention to this?
Yeah, I think what's hard is, at least stereotypically, something I might hear from the right about trans people is just be normal. And something I might hear from the left is kind of transition or suicide. And there's ways that I feel like both of those phrases are missing something. They're not telling the full story, that the people who have experienced gender incongruence since childhood and it's persisting after puberty, they're not choosing this. Like this is a genuine, painful, and difficult experience. And just be normal acts as if they're making it up. You know, at the same time, you know, we know that research does not show medical transition to be effective at reducing depression or suicide among trans people. And so it's neither of those solutions are adequate. And so what if we can move away from those extremes toward each other and say trans people are made in God's image? We believe that they are carrying and being invited to steward a difficult kind of brokenness, and many are struggling with mental health, for example, not because they are trans, but because how they've been treated because they are trans. And so how can we get resources to these individuals to care for them around depression and suicidality that's actually effective, you know? And what we know from the research, for example, is like the best practices, the best treatments for anyone's depression and suicide is some combination of exercise, antidepressants, talk therapy, and a robust social support network. Mm-hmm. We can lean into providing those for our friends and loved ones. We can be a part of that social support network generally, and specifically, we can help them get access to those other resources. So I guess I wish more people from both extremes would like move towards that solution.
Yeah.
Believing people in their story and getting them solutions that we know work.
Yeah, that is great. This is a good question. When I speak to people in kind of different perspectives or to different audiences who have, you know, for lack of a better term, you know, more conservative views on this or more progressive views on this, what strikes me is how much they're just in a total bubble where they're not really interacting with people who think differently than they are. In kind of more conservative circles, they have a very kind of, I would say, caricatured and almost extreme vision of a trans person that's more like the craziest online activist you could give, right? That's how all trans people are, right? So there isn't really a sense that like, oh, I could have, you know, a sincerely Christian trans person in my parish or something. It's important for people who are on the left and who, you know, really genuinely say we want to care for trans people. Well, then you need to pay attention to what research does show about what that looks like Peter mentioned. Like, it doesn't always fit the kind of simplistic ideological narrative or political narrative that's offered. And we don't need to be afraid of doing research in this area, right? Like, if you look at sort of European countries that are wrestling with this in different ways, they're more able to, okay, let's do some high quality research. Let's see where that goes. Let's actually see what works for people who are struggling with gender dysphoria. They're able to more easily go into that conversation, but we're just caught up in our kind of political infighting. And there's a lot more place to meet in the middle, even amidst disagreement, I think. Like what Peter was just mentioning, there are ways in which people who are coming from a traditional Christian perspective can really meaningfully care for people who are struggling with gender incongruence, right? Those aren't mutually exclusive things. We need to really build relationships with people who we see as the other, whether that's a conservative Christian or a progressive trans person or a conservative trans person, right? Because the way we think about this is that those sorts of people don't exist, right? And that's what's been interesting in the project I've been working on the past year. I'm trying to like bring to light the experiences of people that both sides pretend doesn't exist and that get lost in the midst of the culture war.
Mm. And I'll just close this out with a study that Peter quotes in one of his articles that I'll include a link to this article in the show notes. But there is a big report called Us Versus Us. And one of the stats that it gives is that 76% of LGBTQ plus people who had left the faith said they were open to returning. And 92% of those said that their return would not depend on a church changing its theology about sex and gender in order to accommodate them. But the difference was, can I have a fruitful, loving and beloved life of faith here? And if that's true, even as you say, Abigail, within a matrix where we're not agreeing on everything, man, what a witness that would be in our times.
Yeah, I mean, that's staggering, those numbers. Like, that's amazing. I know the study you're talking about. And there's such an opportunity here. Like, there's such an opportunity here for evangelism and for discipleship.
Yeah, could I share maybe just a little personal note here that I've been surprised, you know, as a person who is a Christian, who I don't experience gender incongruence, but I do experience same-sex attraction. I am gay. Like, how engaging with trans topics has challenged me and how I think about femininity and also how I think about my connection with my own body, which has been interesting. As a gay man, kind of effeminacy was always kind of associated with homosexuality when I was a kid. Like any guy who seemed less manly was harassed and accused of being gay, even if they weren't gay. So when I was in the closet, I became pretty obsessed with not coming off as effeminate in any way, because I didn't want to out myself and get treated even worse. But I think in the process, I came to think less of femininity because of the internalized homophobia inside of me. And it was particularly when I started thinking more about trans topics and having conversations with Christian friends navigating gender incongruence that it really shined this big spotlight on some of my own like messed up posture towards gender built up in the closet. And then I've also posted publicly some about my own like struggles with body shame. And while I was kind of reading about and connecting with people about their trans experiences, and particularly the phenomena of like looking in the mirror and feeling disgust towards your own body and feeling tortured by that disgust, like in an odd way I could relate. I'm not trying to say that my experience is as painful or as the same. But like, I think what I've learned from my trans siblings in Christ, particularly those who kind of go to this phrase, resolve what you can, manage what you must, as they're discerning how to wisely steward kind of their broken experience, it really challenged me to think more healthily and realistically about my body shame. You know, this question of resolve what you can and manage what you must. And this is just accepting my limits and the scarcity of my capacity and that like, And an anticipation of like my resurrected body in a variety of ways.
In which you may not have a Brad Pitt six pack.
Yeah, and I won't care.
And, you know, Peter, I think Abigail, you know, maybe you feel the same way. I think probably a vast majority of women, particularly in a culture where women's bodies are highly scrutinized, highly sexualized, 24/7, every square inch, can completely identify with looking in the mirror and saying, I hate this. I wish this was different. I wish I wasn't. You know? So I think just that experience, that pain, that shared pain, and the shared vulnerability of that pain is a great road into saying, tell me your story. You know, who are you? Share this with me, and I'll help you carry this along on the path that God's calling you to walk. Well, I've been speaking today with author and scholar Dr. Abigail Favalli and author, counselor, and pastoral consultant Peter Volk. Abby, Peter, thanks so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much. This is great.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Thanks for tuning in to the Living Church Podcast, a ministry of the Living Church. Snag your ticket now for our Tending the Vineyard Church Growth Conference and use the coupon code PODCAST10 for 10% off your tickets until June 1st. In 2 weeks, I will be enjoying that conference, but I will make sure you can tune in to a very special episode courtesy of our friends at the No Small Endeavor podcast. We'll be running on our feed an episode of their show I find particularly delightful, and I think you will too. The Hillbilly Thomists, Bluegrass, Bourbon, and the Bible. If that doesn't tempt you to join us in Louisville, Kentucky, I don't know what will. Until then, our producer is Leslie Thompson. I'm Amber Noel, your host, and it's been good to be with you. Peace.